This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The American-led coalition in Iraq expected resistance from Sunni Muslims. After all, Saddam Hussein is Sunni, and so are most of the people in his political party, the Ba'ath Party. But now the coalition is facing a Shiite insurrection as well as a Sunni one. The Shiite leader, Muqtada al-Sadr, and his militia seized control of several Iraqi cities last week. The American occupation authority shut down Muqtada's newspaper and said it would try to arrest him in connection with the murder of a Grand Ayatollah last April. General Abizaid, the head of the Central Command, said the mission of U.S. forces is to kill or capture Muqtada al-Sadr, but he also said there would probably end up being a uniquely Iraqi solution. Yesterday, Muqtada began negotiations with several Shiite clerics, including the son of Iraq's leading Shiite cleric, the Grand Ayatollah al-Sistani, who wants the Americans out of Iraq but advocates settling differences peacefully with the help of a new constitution. My guest Juan Cole is a professor of modern Middle East and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and is the author of the book Sacred Space and Holy War, The Politics, Culture, and History of Shiite Islam. I asked him first about Muqtada al-Sadr. Let's start with a brief profile of Muqtada al-Sadr. What is his role in this insurgency?
Well, Muqtada appears to have believed that the Americans had decided to come for him. It should be remembered that he lived his life under the Ba'ath government, which was a repressive police state. And I think he still reads the cues of the occupation authority of the United States through that lens. So when 28 arrest warrants were issued for his close aides Saturday a week ago, I believe that he felt that, that his life was in danger, that he would be arrested and executed. And so he called upon his people to launch an insurrection against the Americans, I think as a way of signaling that he wasn't going to go quietly.
And what is he officially wanted for? What are the charges against him now?
The Coalition Provisional Authority accuses Muqtada of having played a role in the murder on April 10th of 2003, of Abdulmajid al-Khu'i, a prominent cleric who had been in exile in London, came back to Iraq, seems to have had American backing in doing so. And a crowd gathered in the streets of Najaf and stabbed him to death. The allegations are that the crowd was Muqtada's supporters, and further, there are allegations that Muqtada instigated them to act in this way, although he denies it, and there aren't good eyewitness accounts that prove that he ordered a hit.
And he's implicated in another murder, too, isn't he?
Well, the Muqtada al-Sadr movement has an element of thuggishness about it. And there have been a number of incidents in which his followers have armed themselves and have engaged in violence. They are accused of having firebombed cinemas and video stores, liquor stores, of harassing women who didn't bail, indeed of attacking an entire gypsy village south of Diwaniya that was a hotbed of prostitution. And so the problem is, of course, that these actions may have been local, may have been spontaneous. There's not, to my knowledge, good evidence that Muqtada sat down in a room and ordered such things to happen. But there are potentially large numbers of such charges that could be laid at the door of his organization, at least.
Who are Muqtada's followers?
Muqtada's followers appear to be largely young and poor ghetto dwellers. Iraq in the past decade has been economically devastated by the United Nations sanctions and by the way that Saddam Hussein manipulated those sanctions to the benefit of the Ba'ath Party, depriving the majority of Iraqis of gainful employment and medicine and social services and so forth. And particularly the Shiites were out of favor with the Ba'ath Party And so the resources tended to go to the what is now called the Sunni Triangle, the Sunni Arab community. So there were large festering slums. East Baghdad, now called Sadr City, then called Saddam City, may have 2 million residents. There's not much in the way of work there, and many of the people have come in the past two decades from rural backgrounds to settle in the city to look for work. And so it's a very bad situation. It's like the worst of the inner city problems that the United States has seen in the past half century. And it is those ghetto dwellers that in particular have flocked to the standard of Muqtada and who indeed supported his father's movement back in the 1990s.
Well, what do young poor men hear in his message?
Muqtada stands up to the powers that be, and his father did before him. Back in the 1990s, when Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani was more or less keeping quiet, Muqtada's father was speaking out against Saddam, was organizing people for Friday prayers and for various activities, soup kitchens and informal law courts and so forth. And Muqtada's father was killed at Saddam's orders in 1999 for those activities, after which Muqtada took them up covertly. He went underground. So he speaks out. Soon after the fall of the Saddam government in April of 2003, Muqtada came out and said, well, you know, we are grateful to the United States for removing Saddam, but we now insist that the American military forces vacate our country. And there were a certain number of Iraqis who felt that way, who felt that the occupation was a humiliation. Indeed, a recent poll showed that about half of Iraqis feel that way. But no other major political or religious figure tended to come out and say it in those bald terms. So Muqtada is someone who speaks out, speaks his mind, speaks radically, and among the poor and dispossessed, the more nationalistic Iraqis, his message seems fresh and welcome.
Is he taken seriously as a spiritual leader?
He is taken seriously as a spiritual leader, even though that doesn't on the surface make much sense. That is to say, the system prevalent among Shiites in Iraq presumes that religious authority derives from a lifetime of learning and writing, becoming well known, and so it is the typically an older man would emerge as a source of religious authority over time. It's unusual for someone to be looked to for religious guidance who is Muqtada's age, possibly 30 or less, and who hasn't really even finished his degree in Islamic law at the seminary in Najaf. He's an all but dissertation in American terms. But he, because his father built this organization that had enormous personal loyalty to him, that is to Muhammad Sadiq al-Sadr, who was killed in 1999, and because Sadiq al-Sadr was killed and there was no real obvious successor to him inside Iraq, people who followed him transferred their loyalty to Muqtada in a sectarian way. I think this is outside that system of religious learning and recognition that I was talking about before. Muqtada is followed in the way that David Koresh was followed by the Branch Davidians. It's a sectarian, millenarian kind of apocalyptic movement. And so it's quite irrelevant to his fanatical followers that Muqtada does not have those credentials of higher education or of long study and teaching.
In what sense is it an apocalyptic movement?
Well, Shiite Islam has been marked throughout its history by a strong millenarian fervor, by a conviction that the Islamic Promised One, the Mahdi, will return shortly. The Shiite branch of Islam that is prevalent in Iran and Iraq believes that after the Prophet Muhammad's death, he should have been succeeded as vicars by his descendants, by his son-in-law and cousin Ali, who was married to the Prophet's daughter. And then, of course, their children afterwards were descendants of the Prophet. And that line should have provided the leaders of the Muslim community, according to the Shiites. But the line ended with the 12th such leader, called an imam. And the 12th imam was said to have disappeared as a small child into a supernatural realm from which he would one day return, rather as Christians expect the supernatural return of Christ. And so Shiites are awaiting the return of the 12th imam, the Imam Mahdi, the guided one, who is said to, when he comes, he will, it is said that when he comes, he will restore the world to justice, just as the passage of time had filled it with injustice. So Shiites are expecting the Imam Mahdi's return, and the more fervent of them expect him to come very soon. And it appears to be the case that Muqtada's movement is millenarian in this sense. They think the world is getting turned upside down, that there are all kinds of signs and portents that the Imam Mahdi is about to appear. Some of them may believe that Muqtada Sadr is himself the Mahdi, and that is why they call their militia the Army of the Mahdi. It means the army of the coming promised one.
So if you look at the American presence in Iraq from the apocalyptic Shiite point of view, does it have a different meaning than the Americans might see it as having?
Absolutely. Well, the rhetoric of the Americans is that this is a form of the militant spread of democracy. It's a kind of muscular Wilsonianism, a spread of Enlightenment ideals and public discourse and democratic procedures and rationalism. From the point of view of the slums of Iraq, among these young Shiite individuals, the sudden overturn of the Iraqi government and having these foreigners from all these nations stomping around their country in their army boots looks very much like the world being turned upside down, like signs and portents of the coming of the Promised One.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Juan Cole, and he's a professor of Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan. He's the author of several books, including Sacred Space and Holy War, The Politics, Culture, and History of Shiite Islam. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is historian Juan Cole, author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Politics, Culture, and History of Shiite Islam. When we left off, we were talking about the Shiite insurrection in Iraq and its leader, Muqtada al-Sadr. Tell us something about the newspaper that Muqtada runs, which the coalition provisional authority shut down.
The newspaper is called Al-Hawza. I have seen some exemplars of it. It's a slight newspaper. I'm not sure it really can be called a newspaper at all. It's more like a pamphlet. It came out only weekly and had a circulation of only 10,000, mainly through Muqtada Sadr's network of mosques and supporters. I think it's quite a minor affair, and that it was almost certainly much more trouble than it was worth to close it. It was making the most outrageous allegations. For instance, in early March, before the big bombs went off at Karbala and at Qasimiyah in Baghdad, a rocket-propelled grenade hit a Shiite shrine in Qasimiyah, and this was almost certainly the work of Sunni Arab insurgents who were trying to make trouble between the Shiites and the Americans. And Muqtada's paper alleged that this rocket had hit the shrine from above. And in Iraqi terms, this can only mean that it was the doing of the Americans, because they are the only ones with aircraft that could fire from above. Simply not true. And it is inflammatory. And of course, if Shiites took this sort of thing seriously, they might well attack American troops over it. And that is the rationale that was given by Mr. Bremer for closing the newspaper. However, to my knowledge, no Shiites actually did take this allegation seriously, nor, to my knowledge, were any American troops actually accosted on the basis of this report. And so it seems to me that probably it would have been better just to ignore the thing.
Now, one more thing about Muqtada. Since his father, who was a spiritual leader, was killed by Saddam Hussein, you might think that Muqtada would have been more pleased about the Americans coming in and ousting Saddam Hussein.
Well, I think Muqtada was very pleased that the Americans ousted Saddam. Indeed, I think it's clear that during the year before the American invasion, Muqtada was very well aware that it was coming and that he was putting his people in place, expecting an aftermath. And indeed, although Saddam is widely said to have fallen on April 9th, it seems to me clear that already on April 7th, there were no Ba'athists in East Baghdad. The Sudras, the followers of Muqtada, had taken over. But it should be remembered that Muqtada's movement derives from that of his father, the Sadr II movement. And the Sadr II movement really is in the mold of Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran. It harkens back to those themes of the 1980s. And in Khomeinist thought, the United States is the great Satan. Americans have sometimes forgotten that phrase that Khomeini used for the U.S. Mohammed Sadiq al-Sadr, Muqtada's father, had his audiences chant against the United States, chant against Israel. So there's a virulent anti-Americanism and anti-Israel feeling in this movement. Like Khomeinism, it desires an Islamic republic that is ruled by the clerics. And so it's possible for Muqtada to be grateful that the United States has overthrown Saddam, and yet nevertheless to see the continued presence of the United States as an obstacle to all of his main goals.
We've been talking about Muqtada al-Sadr, who is a Shiite leading an insurgency against the American-led coalition in Iraq. Let's talk about the other Shiite leader who's now well-known to Americans, the Grand Ayatollah al-Sistani. Now, these two men are of different generations. Al-Sistani is an older man. Muqtada is, I think, around 30. What are some of the differences beyond the generational differences between the two men?
Sistani is from Iran. It was born there in around 1930 and came to Najaf in Iraq in 1952. He is a representative of an older tradition of Shiite clerical thought, which is often called quietist. That is to say that it does not believe that clerics should get involved in day-to-day politics. It is a tradition that was opposed by Ayatollah Khomeini, and Khomeini wrought a kind of reformation in Shiism, arguing that the clerics should rule. So Muqtada al-Sadr follows his father in having gone over to Khomeini's theories of clerical rule, whereas Sistani never accepted them, and nor did most of the leading clerics of Najaf, which is one of the major theological and legal centers in the Shiite world. It's a place of seminaries where clerics are trained, and it has its own ideological caste. And so Najaf typically does not want to see clerics in government. Sistani believes that clerics should make their views known on important social issues, arguing from an Islamic point of view through rulings or fatwas.
Does al-Sistani see the United States as the great Satan in the same way that Muqtada al-Sadr does?
No, I don't believe he does. I think that he genuinely is grateful to the United States for having overthrown Saddam. And indeed, I think Grand Ayatollah Sistani's main critique of the United States is that it hasn't been true enough to its own ideals and its own promises. Sistani wants one person, one vote democracy in Iraq, and he wants it yesterday. And he insists that without one person, one vote kinds of elections, nothing that is done in Iraq is ultimately legitimate. And so if there's going to be a constitution, it has to be written by people who were elected to a constitutional convention by the Iraqi people. If there's going to be a government, it must be elected by the Iraqi people in order to represent their will. That is his Islamic legal ruling, that government must derive from the will of the people. And he doesn't believe that since the fall of Saddam, anything the United States has done in Iraq really has tended towards that result. Everything has been done through appointments and through influenced processes, cronyism, and so forth. And so he thinks this entire enterprise is illegitimate because it does not derive from the will of the people.
Juan Cole is a professor of Middle East and South Asian history at the University of Michigan, and author of Sacred Space and Holy War. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're talking about the insurgencies in Iraq. The leader of the Shiite insurgency, Muqtada al-Sadr, and the leading Shiite cleric, the Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, who wants the Americans out but supports peaceful change. My guest Juan Cole is an expert on modern Islamic movements. He's a professor of Middle East and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and author of the book Sacred Space and Holy War, The Politics, Culture, and History of Shiite Islam. What is the relationship between the Grand Ayatollah al-Sistani and Muqtada al-Sadr, who have emerged as the two leaders of the Shiites?
Well, Sistani and Muqtada don't get along, and as indeed Sistani did not get along with Muqtada's father, Muhammad Sadiq al-Sadr, because of their different views of the role of the Shiite clergy and the future of Iraq and their different methods of politics, Sistani being a quietist and simply speaking out, sometimes calling for peaceful demonstrations, Muqtada organizing a militia and agitating for an Islamic Republic. So they don't get along, and indeed, soon after the fall of Saddam, Muqtada's followers surrounded Sistani's house in Najaf and gave him 48 hours to get out of town or threatened to kill him. And Sistani's supporters among the tribal chieftains came into town and forestalled this development. So I think there's very bad blood between the two. But it's a very complex relationship because Sistani, I think, also would not like to see Muqtada treated unjustly. I think he would not like to see Muqtada dragged away in chains by the Americans. And I think all the Shiites in Iraq, even if they deeply dislike Muqtada, would be very nervous about that kind of development because it looks tyrannical to them. It looks as though an imperial power is coming in and cracking down hard on one of their own, even if he is one of their own black sheep.
Now, when the United States and the coalition it led invaded Iraq, I think the official word was we were expecting resistance from the Sunni because Saddam Hussein was a Sunni Muslim. His party, the Ba'ath Party, was predominantly Sunni. But I think there was more support expected from the Shiites because the Shiites had been terribly oppressed under Saddam Hussein. Even though they were the majority group, they were oppressed by the Sunni minority. Were you surprised at the Shiite insurgency?
No, actually, I'm... Terry, the people who made the American policy towards Iraq, the invasion and the occupation afterwards, are not stupid people. They're often quite bright. But I have to say that on the whole and by and large, they're extremely ignorant people. And they really did not know what Iraq was like. They had no idea. Paul Wolfowitz, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, gave an NPR interview last year this time, before the war, and said that the Shiites of Iraq would be better friends for the United States than the Wahhabis of Saudi Arabia because they were secular. And then there isn't in Iraq that problem of holy cities the way there is in Saudi Arabia. I mean, he appears not to have known about Najaf and Karbala, and he seems to have thought that the Shiites of Iraq were secularists. And it simply wasn't true, and anyone who had been following Iraq knew that those statements, you know, needed a great deal of nuance. I think that the American administration mainly depended upon what they were told by expatriates like Ahmad Chalabi, who was from a Shiite family, but which left Iraq in 1958, and simply didn't know what the situation was. Nobody knew that Muqtada's father had this massive movement, even though there were books about it in Arabic. They didn't realize that, you know, the slums had been organized for Khomeinist purposes under Saddam. And they thought of Saddam's government as totalitarian, as controlling everything, whereas, in fact, we know that that there were substantial covert political movements among the Shia that Saddam's people were never able to stamp out. And so what really was happening was that Shiite Iraq, the 65% in the south, was a cauldron of cells and conspiracies and militias and neighborhood politics that Saddam tried to keep a lid on with brutal and massive violence. And what the United States really did was to go in and take off that lid.
Well, you know, I think there was this expectation that after the invasion, that the Shiites would support us, the Sunni, at least temporarily, would oppose us because we had deposed the Sunni leader Saddam Hussein, but certainly that the Shiites and the Sunni would be on different sides of the fence. I mean, they have been opposed to each other for so long in Iraq, but now it looks like there are Shiite and Sunni insurgencies against the United States. Do you think that the Shiites and the Sunni are actually working together now?
Well, there is evidence of them working together. In fact, when the Americans were besieging Fallujah, the Shiites of Qasimiyya in Baghdad and the Sunnis of Azamiyya in Baghdad, which are contiguous neighborhoods that have a long history of mutual rivalry and turf wars, actually made common cause and got together a big convoy of 60 relief trucks and went out to Fallujah to try to get aid to the Sunni people of Fallujah. So that was an example of Shiites donating blood, of donating goods, of putting themselves in harm's way for the sake of these Sunnis. And I think that the Iraqi nationalism as a phenomenon tends to be disregarded by Western observers. And I'm really puzzled by this. I mean, it is true that Iraq is a new country, as many third world countries were, grew out of a colonial experience. The British carved it out of the Ottoman Empire and so forth. But it has existed as an independent country since 1932, which is a long time. And it's certainly long enough for educational institutions and political institutions to foster a sense of national identity. And Iraqis, in my experience, have tended to be extremely nationalistic. And just to give you an example, during the Iran-Iraq War, which Saddam launched against Iran in 1980, and which lasted for 8 years, from 1980 to 1988, there was relatively little defection from the ranks of the Shiite Iraqis to Khomeini's side. So, and the army was very largely Shiite conscripts of the Iraqi army. So you had hundreds of thousands of Iraqi Shiites fighting to the death for 8 years against Iranian Shiites across the border who were invading their country, side by side with the Republican Guards and the Sunni Arabs of Iraq. So, I mean, there is a recent historical precedent for them getting together to face an outside invader.
My guest is Juan Cole, professor of Middle East and South Asian history at the University of Michigan. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is historian Juan Cole, author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Politics, Culture, and History of Shiite Islam. One of the issues that's facing Iraq now is the majority versus the minority. Is there majority rule? How much power do the minorities have? Can you just talk a little bit about the dilemmas that will face Iraq as it tries to come up with a constitution?
Well, the Iraqis, in a way, it seems to me, face a very similar situation to that faced by the founding fathers of the United States. And I'm a little bit puzzled by the decisions that have been made so far. For instance, the interim constitution calls for just one house of parliament. But you know, we have this system of a lower house Congress and the upper house, the Senate, precisely because the Senate overrepresents the small states and it's kind of a protection for minorities, and that might otherwise face a tyranny of the majority. So since we know that the Iraqi Shiites are the majority of the country, 60-65%, they're likely to dominate in parliament. And if it only has one house, then there is a danger of a tyranny of the majority. So far, that danger has been addressed by giving, say, the Kurds a veto over a future constitution, or it has been addressed by trying to make sure that there are three presidents representing each of the major religious communities. But those kinds of measures don't seem to me to be ideal. I don't understand why they don't just have two houses of parliament and have the upper house overrepresent the Sunnis in such a way as to prevent a tyranny of the Shiite majority.
If President Bush called you up and asked you for advice about what we should do next, what would you tell him?
Well, first of all, we have to get back to where we were before the blow-up last week. And so I would say that a negotiated settlement with Muqtada Sadr that did not commit the United States to trying to arrest or kill him would be highly desirable. His followers are going to make no end of trouble if we continue to go after him in that way. And they're not that big a danger if they're left alone, but I think they are a big danger if they're pursued. Then I think that Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani is perfectly right, that the only hope for a legitimate government in Iraq, one that can attract the allegiance of the Iraqi people, is to go to elections as soon as possible. And if anything, the current deadline for elections of January 2005 should be moved up to this fall. I think that the sooner the elections can be held, the sooner you'll have a government in Iraq that the Iraqis feel represents them.
If there were an election very soon, as al-Sistani would like to see, what would the outcome likely be?
Well, if Iraqis vote on a one-person, one-vote basis, it seems likely that 15% or so of the seats will be held by Kurdish Sunnis. Another 15 or 16% of the seats will be held by Arab Sunnis. And then some 65% of the seats will be held by Shiites, with the Christians and the Turkmen and other small minorities having a few seats each. Since the Shiites are themselves divided, it would be possible in such a situation for the 30-some percent of the members of parliament who are Sunni to put together coalitions, say, with middle-class, more secular-minded Shiites, and perhaps emerge with a secular majority in the parliament, even though the religious parties certainly are going to do well and would have a prominent role. It's not clear that they could, however, impose a Shiite theocracy on a country that is, after all, that has a substantial Sunni minority of that sort. Elections are a risk. Obviously, they didn't work out very well when they were held in Bosnia after the conflict there. But I think we're now at a situation in Iraq where the risk of not having them is much greater than the risk of having them. And I think, and actually Grand Ayatollah Sistani has said this as well, that because Iraq is a relatively diverse place, it's likely that any parliament that is elected now will be sufficiently diverse as to prevent any kind of tyranny of the Shiite majority.
You know, you've described the Grand Ayatollah al-Sistani as being, you know, a kind of force for democracy in Iraq. Would he smile on women running for office or women's rights in Iraq?
Sistani is a conservative man, and his tradition is frankly patriarchal. You know, his followers at least seem to have an open mind on some of these issues. It seems clear that he supports the vote for women. And when some of Muqtada's followers were harassing women and insisting that they veil, Sistani gave a ruling, a fatwa, that it is illegitimate to force women to veil. Also, one of his key aides said that although in Islamic law drinking is forbidden, whether to drink or not should be up to the individual. So Sistani is in a tradition where you know, individual conscience is very important, and there are laws, and one ought to follow them. But coercion and using the levers of the state to deprive people of their rights is not allowed. And so I think that Sistani's position on women would be compatible with a certain amount of freedom for them in the new Iraq.
A certain amount.
Yes. I think we have to face the facts that Sistani would want certain laws to be enacted in accordance with Islamic law that would restrain women in certain ways. You know, in Islamic law, there's no alimony. So if you had a strict version of Islamic law as the law of the land in Iraq, women could be divorced with impunity, and men would not have responsibility for them after 3 months. And this actually was implemented even in secular India for Muslim women because of a legal case there. So there are many elements of the more medieval interpretation of Islamic law. And Islamic law itself is not set in stone, of course, but the more conservative interpretations of it, which I think are characteristic of Sistani, which would detract from women's rights.
After the Israeli military assassinated Sheikh Yassin, who was the spiritual leader of Hamas, Muqtada al-Sadr said that he wanted to open Iraqi chapters of Hamas and Hezbollah. How do you interpret that?
Well, I think it has to be recognized by American audiences that the majority of Iraqis support the Palestinian cause. And very large numbers of Iraqis were deeply upset by the Israeli assassination of Sheikh Yassin. In the United States and Israel, Sheikh Yassin is seen as a terrorist, and many deaths of innocent people are laid to his door. But in Iraq, he's seen as somebody who is standing against an occupation, as a freedom fighter. So there's a sense in which both the uprising in Fallujah, which explicitly was done in the name of Sheikh Yassin, and the crackdown on Muqtada, which came after he made this declaration of solidarity with Hamas, came out of the Sharon government's decision to take out Yassin with a helicopter gunship. Muqtada and his father before him are strong supporters of the Palestinian cause. The idea that Shiite Iraqis would be anything but sympathetic to Hezbollah, which is a Lebanese Shiite group in South Lebanon that has fought Israeli occupation of Lebanon, seems to me to have always been a non-starter. It's natural that the Iraqi Shiites would be sympathetic to Hezbollah, and overthrowing Saddam was always going to be a net plus for Hezbollah in Lebanon. So I don't find anything particularly surprising about Muqtada's announcement of solidarity with Hamas and Hezbollah. And indeed, Grand Ayatollah Sistani, who's a much more cautious and venerable figure, has also condemned the death of Yassin and has called for solidarity with Palestinians.
You said that deposing Saddam was always going to be a net gain for Hezbollah and Hamas, but that was certainly not what the Bush administration had in mind. I mean, they saw overthrowing Saddam Hussein as paving the way for peaceful settlement in the Middle East.
Yes, in 1996, Richard Pearl, one of the advocates of the Iraq War, and Douglas Feith, who is now the number three man in the Pentagon, the Undersecretary of Defense for Planning, issued a position paper for Benjamin Netanyahu of the Likud party in Israel, in which they advocated an Iraq war precisely for the purpose of moderating Hezbollah and removing support for the Palestinians. So this outcome of possibly strengthening the Palestinian cause and Hezbollah in Lebanon was not foreseen by the neoconservative intellectuals who advocated the Iraq war. And this is simply because they, on the whole and by and large, knew nothing about Iraq, and their 1996 proposal is full of implausible assertions and frankly, science fiction.
Juan Cole is a professor of Middle East and South Asian history at the University of Michigan, an author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Politics, Culture, and History of Shiite Islam.